The novel has long been celebrated as an art form that captures the complexity of human life, often by portraying the human condition in the density of its everyday circumstances. But today's guest sees the novel as an expressly theological exercise.
The incarnation is that place of intersection between God and humanity. And without that, we don't have that kind of dignity valuing of creation that I think fiction just assents to.
I'm speaking today with Christina Bieber-Lake, who is the Clyde S. Kilby Professor of English at Wheaton College and the author of the 2019 book, Beyond the Story, American Literary Fiction and the Limits of Materialism. We will discuss how theology helps us understand literature, whether those same principles apply to literary criticism, how one finds one's purpose as a teacher and scholar, and what it means to help other people find their own. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Welcome, Christina. It's great to have you here in this podcast.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I like asking people how they imagine faith in their life and work, and you provide a great entree in your book, The Flourishing Teacher, just out this past year, 2020, where you write, and I'm quoting you here, "The purpose behind all of my work is to help others to learn how to be filled with all the fullness of God." It's a beautiful sentence. How do you define that fullness?
Well, I have a strong version in my mind of what human flourishing means. And it means doing what we were made to do, which is to give glory to God, to enjoy Him forever, as the Catechism says. And to me, to flourish means to seek Him, to be found by Him, and to grow in Him. So that's what I mean by the fullness of God.
Very good. And you teach at Wheaton College, a religious institution, and it's easy for me to imagine how that might, what form that might take in the classroom. In BYU, where I work and teach, is also a religious institution. Does that happen also in your, does that kind of flourishing happen in your scholarship as well as teaching? Is it as easy to do there, or is it harder?
It's a good question. I mean, you know, because I was hired by Wheaton, it enabled me, it gave me the freedom to pursue my interest in the intersection of faith and learning, as we put it at Wheaton. So it's become easier to do simply because I'm not only free to do it, I'm expected to do it in my scholarship here at the college. So, but I do view it more as a freedom than an expectation. So I love, to me, if something is the truth, then the truth is going to find its way into every discipline that you can teach. And so I love thinking about faith through fiction.
Okay, great. And that, on that, that's a good segue, because we're going to talk primarily about this really terrific new book of yours titled Beyond the Story. And you set up a question I want to ask you. I've got to say in advance, I have the book right here in front of me, and we could spend actually our entire conversation with me reading passages and just getting your response to them. But here are a couple that I'd like to sort of bring up at the outset. You write here, I'm at the beginning of the introduction, you write that storytelling is a theological activity because it continually affirms and reaffirms the transcendent value of personal being. And then you also say, in the introduction, every human life has dignity, meaning, and eternal significance, whether a particular human being displays the ability to understand these ideas or not. The arts, and especially the art of storytelling, are an expression of that dignity, meaning, and eternal significance. They are an effort to touch it. It's a great sentence.
Thank you.
You know, you introduce the framework for your study here as Christian theism, and I'm wondering why you take that kind of fine-grained theological approach and not, say, an appeal to a less defined but broadly evocative category like religious experience or post-secularity.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate that question because it's very important to my work, because I started out as a Flannery O'Connor scholar. I still consider myself a Flannery O'Connor scholar. And she called fiction an incarnational art. So everything that I think about with regard to fiction originated there. and has to do with the fact that the incarnation is that place of intersection between God and humanity. And without that, we don't have that kind of dignity valuing of creation that I think fiction just assents to. It doesn't necessarily argue for it, but it assents to it just naturally by the attention that's paid to human beings. And that's, attention is a really important part of my argument. It's a way that the author sees the characters as having significance, as having meaning. Well, God found humanity worth dying for, and so becomes a part of the incarnation. So to my mind, this kind of thinking is deeply Christian. That doesn't mean that you can't make the argument from a theistic perspective, but in my mind, it's deepened by the incarnation. The argument is deepened by the incarnation.
Okay, great. And well, we'll get to parts of that, I hope, in our conversation here in a little bit. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll come back to the question of the post-secular, perhaps. Another couple passages that I think are really quite striking about the book that get to this kind of theological aspect of it. There's one here, it's page 77. This is the chapter, I believe, it's Beyond Evolution. So it's the chapter on Flannery O'Connor, as a matter of fact. I mean, you write there that we make up stories because they are the only way to see and to say the truth that lies beyond them. And then an earlier place in the book, this is in the end of chapter one, you write this, you say, art is a virtue of the practical intellect. The artist sees with God and participates in God's glory with what she makes. So that notion that stories are an effort for us to put our finger or to speak and say the truth that lies beyond them, and that in doing so, the artist participates in God's glory. Can you elaborate a little bit on what that means in the context of, you know, American fiction?
Yeah, well, you're asking me to reiterate my book.
But, that's exactly what I'm asking you to do.
Yeah. Right, and that, of course, is difficult. I mean, the subtitle is, the American literary fiction and the limits of materialism. And the starting point for my argument was simply to say that materialism or scientific naturalism, however you want to put it, cannot tell the whole story about why we tell stories, but why we do all art, not just storytelling. It just so happens that I'm focused on storytelling, right? But I start with actually the caves at Chauvet as my example about how art touches the transcendent necessarily. So to my mind, it's saying that when an artist is showing you something, this is what the artist is doing. They're saying, here's this thing, I want you to see it, that they're asking you to see something that you wouldn't otherwise see, particularly if you had just a materialistic kind of outlook on it. Like, you wouldn't see the significance of a human being. You wouldn't see the significance of a particular event that happens to somebody. But the artist is the one that helps you to see that. And by that act, they're agreeing with God about the significance and meaning. Even those artists who don't think that they are, like Sartre, right? I make a big deal about Sartre's whole thinking that our existence is meaningless, and yet he focuses on these characters, brings them to life, and asks us to look at them. That's an inherent contradiction. And I think it's, in other words, art is inherently theological because it asks us to look at something and insists that looking at it is important and that thing has meaning.
Yeah, terrific. I'm as I hear you say that, it resonates for me with other arguments that one hears. You know, when these days one hears often discussions in academic culture about the crisis of the humanities, right? Mm-hmm, that there's a crisis of confidence in the humanities, that they don't get people jobs the same way, allegedly, and therefore we shouldn't fund them in universities the same way, allegedly, and so on. And an argument that I often hear humanists make, including secular humanists, is that, well, no, the humanities have great value because they can help explain why we care about the things that we care about, who we are and how we are made, such that we're able to care about the things that we care about, why, what makes us human. And mm-hmm. and that's an argument that's kind of structurally parallel to what you're arguing, but you really do make the additional argument that this is an inherently, would you say, is that true? Is that it's an inherently mm-hmm. or structurally theological argument?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, that is the thesis in a nutshell, that storytelling is inherently theological, and scientific naturalist accounts of human experience can't explain why we tell stories and what we get from them. Neither of those things can be explained by scientific naturalist accounts. And I've given some of those accounts and shown, I hope, the limits of them. You know, and one of the main intersections where you can see the limits is in the fact of what philosophers call robust first-person perspective, the fact that I'm aware of myself as a person. You know, science really can't explain why that should be the case. And so when you hear people trying to make arguments for where human consciousness comes from, it's all like, well, it just evolved. It was an emergent, you know, faculty. And there's really just no explanation for it. And once you get to the other end with quantum mechanics and quantum physics, then you really start to see the weirdness of the person, the personality, if you will, of the universe, how there is some sort of observational quality to our existence, the fact of being observed. And I'm doing a lot of thinking about that now. I'm thinking about witness right now. I'm working on attention and the fact that we are our attention and how that intersects with quantum mechanics. So that's where my next book is going, just FYI. So.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
I've done actually a fair amount of thinking about witnessing myself. My first book actually, mm-hmm. Which is not a book about theology overtly, though it has, I think, an inherently theological argument. It's about actually what it meant to witness something happening first person.
That's good. I should read that then, because that's what I'm thinking about right now too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I could point you to especially a particular chapter might be useful to you in that book. So for
please
later,
do.
Okay, we'll talk about that after this is through,
because what's the storyteller doing but witnessing something and helping us to see, like McCarthy talks about this all the time, Cormac McCarthy, who is one of my favorite American writers. So yeah, I would very much like to read that chapter.
Okay, great, because that's actually a book in some ways about the kind of the origins of modern literary fiction, the emergence of literature and the kind of its modern formation. That's to be talked about, I guess, later. I want to know what you're working on later too, but I'll ask you about that maybe in a little bit.
Sure.
You mentioned this robust first-person perspective as one of the things that characterizes literary fiction, which gives it its kind of theological edge, is maybe the wrong word, but its theological orientation. You also mm-hmm. talk about that fiction relies on the particular and irreplaceable bodies of others, and that you call it kind of a consummating consciousness. Mm-hmm. Can I ask you about those other two categories, you know, that it relies on the particular and irreplaceable bodies of others, and that it's a consummating consciousness?
Yeah, the term consummating consciousness comes from Bakhtin, who is the theorist that I draw a lot on, because he understood that the problem with modernity, that's a huge statement, but is that Descartes, you know, divided mind from body and elevated the mind and just made it abstract, made philosophical concepts abstract, epistemology abstract, all of that, and that is a disembodied kind of a way of thinking about the other. And for Bakhtin and for my own research, the other is just constantly resisting that. The actual existence of particular persons in their embodied state, their irreplaceability, resists Cartesian categories, right? You just can't abstract somebody into a stat. Even though our culture, our technocratic culture, wants to do that all the time, it's a truly dangerous, modern inheritance that we've got. There's a book out there that I haven't read yet that I really want to read called The Weapons of Math Destruction. and I just love that title. I love books that make the argument in their title that you, when you try to squeeze people into abstractions, into numbers, they inherently resist that. And fiction is anecdotal, right, in that way, right? It insists that each individual particular experience is actually significant and resists those categorizations. Something is outside of what can be put in a chart. And again, that's that for me, the thinking about that started with Flannery O'Connor, her great story, The Violent Barred Away. The main character is this modern guy named Raber who is just, you know, trying to get things to be just so, and finds that, nope, human experience lies outside of that, can't be reduced. Nice. And shouldn't be diverse, reduced, because diversity goes away. The gratuity of creation goes away if you reduce people to a chart, right? And this is the thing that makes creation so wonderful, is that it's full of diverse individual consciousnesses, right?
Right,
but and that's consciousness that are embodied, right? Because their uniqueness is embodied. You don't have just some kind of disembodied brain like you would with Descartes.
Right, and it's that particularity that brings us back to that we said a minute ago about that robust first-person perspective. It's that you see something unique, and there's the inclination to point to it and say, that right there is worthy of attention, right? And I guess
exactly
from that,
so.
You're saying fiction is born, yeah, that kind of activity.
Yes, exactly, yep.
It's a very compelling argument, I think, and very well organized. In fact, the book here titled Beyond the Story, the chapters actually set themselves up in a series of beyonds. In chapter one, beyond the author; chapter two, beyond the self; chapter three, beyond the brain, and so on and so forth. At its core, this is kind of a rhetorical evocation of transcendence, right? It's beyond, it can't be reduced, it's irreducible. Mm-hmm. And it is motivated by this desire to go beyond materialisms, whether they be defined as natural or social. Materialism here, is it just here as like a rhetorical accident, as a good way to make a case for a theological perspective, or have you been kind of keeping your eye on, you know, sort of culture and said, I want to write about something that talks about that or against that? Like, why did you feel compelled to make the case against materialisms the way that you do?
Well, that just shows the line in my research from the incarnational art of Flannery O'Connor to Prophets of the Posthuman, where I make an argument that the biotechnological revolution has this kind of scientific naturalist kind of viewpoint behind it, that there is no transcendent world there. And so I've always been thinking about this question. And now I just brought part of the argument that I was making in Prophets to the specific notion of fiction being the art of love for persons. I had mentioned that in Prophets of the Posthuman, but I extend and make that argument. So it's not just a rhetorical move, it's the core. I think of fiction as resisting scientific naturalist accounts of human experience.
Okay.
It just inherently resists it. It just says, no, there's something beyond. And as soon as you're reading a story, you touch that beyond.
Great.
Yeah.
You know, you're obviously, because you mentioned your previous work, and it is very informed by, these accounts. You're not afraid to engage, these accounts of various kinds of determinisms and materialisms and technocratic society, et cetera, and which I really appreciate about it. I'm wondering in your research if you ever find yourself once in a while really stopping your tracks by some of the more persuasive aspects of these arguments, though, these scientific arguments that really do inspire their own kind of wonder. And is the wonder inspired by science the same kind of wonder as the wonder inspired by fiction?
That's such a great question. And of course, I have had moments where I'm reading something that's purely scientific and it's so compelling. But if you talk to scientists, who actually do science on the ground, like actually do science, not pseudoscientists, as Marilynne Robinson would call people like Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins, but like actual scientists, they are actually open to there being a kind of significance or a meaning beyond that. Most of them are, or they don't think about it, right? It's not in their day-to-day work. I love what Thomas Nagel calls, and he's not a Christian, so he's not, you know, arguing from that perspective, but the Darwinianism of the gaps. It's just such a brilliant phrase, because it takes that God of the gaps argument and says, no, actually, we do this Darwinian thing of the gap, Darwin of the gaps. And it's the fact of that kind of the new atheism that really bugs me, you know. But when I read just actual hard science, I just haven't read anything that convinces me that somehow that consciousness is this emergent property, like we were talking about before. So it's like the more I read, the more I get drawn back to the incarnation as the most satisfying explanation for why humans are the way they are. So in other words, the more I study science, the more I become convinced about theological truths.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Particularly the personality of the universe, like the and I mentioned quantum mechanics, so I just want to go back there for a second because the quantum theory is weird. You know, it's weird, and science can't just go in there and just explain away the question of consciousness. They still have so much work to do with thinking about where consciousness comes from, the effect that witnessing the world, observing the world, has on it. You know.
Yes, that's right. Let me ask you this then. This is what you say resonates with me, and I'm wondering kind of how you'd respond to something that I hear on occasion from friends of mine who are wonderful academics and good human beings who are also secular humanists who've expressed to me concerns about Christianity, at least in a lot of its American iterations, as being a deeply kind of anti-scientific having anti-scientific tendencies. You know, you, again, you're a scholar, you engage science, you're obviously, you're a dedicated Christian. How do you negotiate the practical problem, either of faith communities pushing back against science or having to explain to other scholars, well, no, not actually. How do you negotiate that kind of conflict?
Oh gosh, that's a huge question. I know you're aware of that. I mean, I my space as a Christian academic, especially even at Wheaton, I live right in purple America. My parents are this kind of like anti-science science evangelicals. You know, just today I had a conversation with my mother about the vaccine. I'm going to try to get the COVID-19 vaccine as fast as I can. And my mom is distrustful of it. So I live that reality. And then I live inside of academia where it's like they assume that because I'm a Christian writing from a Christian perspective that I'm afraid of science or don't really understand science. So I'm navigating that constantly. And I think that all Christian scholars just have to show that there's no reason to be afraid of science, that reading the science, digging deep into the science is the way to go, right? So we have to do it. And I'm inherently interested in it, so it's not difficult for me, but I feel like this is the place where Christian humanists need to go.
Yeah, well, thank you for fighting that good fight. That's important.
Thank you.
You know, I've been reading the work recently, I just discovered it recently, of Belden Lane. I don't know if you've read his work at all, but he's a theologian who's written about like nature and the glories of nature, and he makes the argument that Calvin was a great beholder of nature, and that more closely we gaze at nature, the more we perceive the presence of nature's creator. And it's a really wonderful, and he's a gorgeous writer, Belden Lane. It's a very good crossover between then the theological and the very attentive to nature on terms that would be appreciated by just nature writers. For what it's
I
worth.
I love that.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
No, there's something about the natural world, and I get this really from Thoreau. Even though Henry David Thoreau, wasn't a Christian, he understood that to be a naturalist is to be a poet. Like they're connected. And to be a poet means to have this movement toward metaphor, that you're always trying to see something in terms of something else, trying to see spirit in terms of matter, which it makes the point that spirit does exist, that spiritual things, meaning, significance of the natural world, right? That it's not disconnected. And so there's a certain thing about writing itself, poetry or fiction or whatever, that just touches on that. Metaphor, to me, I'm so excited about metaphor. I can't even tell you how exciting metaphor is, because Robert Frost called it the height of thinking. And I agree with that. And that's because the world is not just the physical world around us, right? That we're always, and this is the way that a phenomenologist would think about it, right? We're moving toward understanding things and sharing those things with other people. And of course, there's this whole school of thought, the evolutionary school of thought, sociobiology, that would just insist, well, that's just, we needed to do that. It was important to be altruistic because it helps humans survive. But if you really look at those accounts, they just aren't enough. They aren't enough to explain language, the richness of language. You know, so much is just not there. So anyway, I wax poetic.
No, okay, there's a good transition here, though, because I noticed in your other book, The Flourishing Teacher, you got a section there where you talk a bit about Robert Frost and his poem Birches, which is a glorious poem that illustrates some of what you're talking about here, which I really love.
Yes.
And about metaphor and what it does and waxing poetic and what it means actually to invoke metaphor, which really moves. Metaphor is inherently moving. When it strikes the mind, it often, there's a sensuous, beautiful quality to it. One of the points you make in Beyond the Story, I'm going to quote from it here because you say things so beautifully often. Here's what you write. This is page 11, still the introduction. You say, aesthetic beauty can never be severed from the goodness that the artist sees in the world. There is no such thing as art for art's sake. Beauty calls us to stand in awe of the wonder of being itself, and our bliss testifies to that awe. It's such a beautiful couple sentences. You made the point that beauty always evokes not just itself, but also what is true and what is good. And I'm wondering if you can sort of speak to why that's also important for how we understand fiction.
Yeah, those categories and that way of thinking about it, I got mostly from Hans Urs von Balthasar, the Catholic theologian who, you know, he's written so much, and just to even, dip your toes into that, it's a lot of work. But it's so great because for von Balthasar, not to go too far afield, the goodness, truth, and beauty are these transcendentals that are connected, but they're not, and I don't want to put Plato under the bus because Plato, I don't think is the problem. Descartes is the problem, right? But they're not transcendentals in the way that Plato has been misinterpreted to be arguing, right? Because the incarnation, these things are connected. Like because the incarnation, you know, manifests God in human form, goodness and truth and beauty are connected in the form, in the appearance of the form of Christ. So aesthetics are necessarily theological, and theology is necessarily aesthetic at the same time. And it's a mouthful, but I really believe that that's true. And I got that from von Balthasar.
Fantastic.
So that when you see something beautiful, and by beauty, I do not mean pretty. It's really important that we not, you know, confuse those terms. Something beautiful, like if you think of Isaiah, he had nothing in his form to draw us to him. There was nothing beautiful about the Jesus, right? About the incarnation. But that's beauty in the way that I'm using the term. The beauty of the human form, the beauty of the created world. But he's not pretty, right?
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
But isn't it right? And you can refresh me if I'm wrong on this. So this is a Balthasar aside before I ask you a question about the incarnation. But Balthasar, Kant famously gets to beauty last as a way to resolve this antinomy or this inherent conflict between the claims about saying something is true and the claims about saying something is good. And he finds you can resolve those if you go to the category of beauty, and how he does it's kind of beside the point. But Balthasar kind of inverts that, right? Begins with what is beautiful and then arrives eventually at what's good and what's true. So it's all born out of this kind of experience of beautiful things.
Mm-hmm. And that, I believe, is linked to his deeply incarnational thinking, right? And it's Jens Zimmermann who picks up on that in his books that I've learned a lot from, like incarnational humanism and just understanding. And this, again, this goes back to Flannery O'Connor. To write an incarnational art is not to say I take the physical world and then I give it the meaning from the spiritual realm. It's that that meaning is already there. And by focusing on the world as it is, you will see that meaning. And that's what beauty is the world as it is in all of its weirdnesses. Now it's fallen. Okay. And O'Connor would say that the world is fallen, but that doesn't mean that it ceases to be beautiful as the created thing that it is. There are ugly things that we do, but remember, and this is Augustinian, right? Evil is the absence of the good. It's not a substance, right? I think about an apple, and it's like everybody, when you see a rotten apple, you only know that it's rotten because you know what a good ripe apple is supposed to look like, right? You don't say then apples are evil because occasionally they rot, right?
Yeah.
That's what I mean by beauty. And you could make a beautiful picture of a rotten apple because there's truth there, right? Do you see what I'm saying? So,
Yeah, good. You bet.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, this is a disputed point. I have a good friend, Michael Farmer, who we argue about this all of the time, right? Because it is, and I do have a lot more thinking to do about it. And I don't want, you can go really far afield when you get into the beauty conversations. I mean, you end up with George Steiner and just a lot of really difficult stuff. And I don't want to make it sound like it's simplistic. That's just where my thinking is about it right now.
Okay, fair enough. Let me ask you then about the incarnation. Something that you've talked about throughout the book, and there's a passage here in your chapter on Toni Morrison, which I think is a compelling way to put this. This is on page 91, but you write, and you invoke the category of the grotesque, so you have to explain to us what you mean by grotesque in this context, but you write this: the incarnation of Christ is grotesque because its shocking connection of human and divine is necessarily revelatory. Mm-hmm. In the incarnation, ultimate good appears in human form, healing and blessing. It reveals love. It shows the way and does it. It does not just teach about it.
Yeah, you know, that chapter I wrote before I wrote this book. It was published separately and before I wrote Prophets of the Posthuman and after I had been working on Flannery O'Connor. And it that shows again how all of my thinking is connected, and it's all kind of anti-Gnostic, right? That's one of the ways to think about my research interests, because of the incarnation, right? So the grotesque is an artistic device, and this is again, I got this from O'Connor, that is used to conjoin two things together that we do not normally conjoin together, so that we can see something, so that we're shocked into seeing something. So, and that is the way in which the incarnation is grotesque, because God and man don't normally go together, right? We think of them as completely separate. And so I remember when I was at Emory University and I was working out at the gym and I was like, oh my gosh, the incarnation is the ultimate grotesque. And it just like kind of shocked me. And that opened up a whole new way of thinking about the grotesque, but it's all in O'Connor. So there's like in her work, a negative grotesque and a positive grotesque. The negative grotesque is like, if you have a distorted soul and it shows on your body, like a rotten apple kind of thing. And then the positive grotesque is that which draws us to it because of its incongruity. God becoming man. And so we have this kind of push-pull. It both repels us and draws us to it. And that's where Flannery O'Connor's work ended up at the end of her career. She died at age 39 with the ultimate example of this kind of thinking, which is Parker's Back. And any listener within the sound of my voice who has not read Parker's Back and is interested in this question, run to go read Parker's Back. Because it's this guy who gets his tattoo on his back of Jesus and realizes, we recognize as readers that we are Christ bearers, right? That we bear Christ. We're not little Christ, but we bear Christ. Mm. So great book. But that is really about art too. That story, it's about a lot of things. Anyway.
Okay. Do you have, O'Connor's in this book, and you've done so much thinking about O'Connor. I'm wondering if you have a favorite chapter in the book. Is it, and if you do have a favorite chapter, whether it is the particular topic of the chapter that makes it a favorite, or whether it is one of the authors that either is familiar to you that you're revisiting, like O'Connor, or whether it's one of the newer authors you haven't addressed before that you take up.
Yeah, it depends on what day you ask me, but lately my favorite chapter really is the Cormac McCarthy chapter, because I think one thing that I could be writing next is a book on Cormac McCarthy. So I've always been interested in the road and the way that it touches theological things, particularly because there's this strand of McCarthy scholarship that says that he's a nihilist, and I just don't see that there. And I wanted to make the case that the beauty of the book, The Road, the beauty of the prose, is not this empty category like Amy Hungerford talks about, a belief in belief for its own sake, but is necessary because of the truth of the affirmation of human life that's found at the center of that story. So there's a way in which the whole book started there, right? So that has to be my favorite chapter for that reason. But I also really like the Lydia Davis chapter, because Lydia Davis is this funky short story writer, and I really dealt with the science kind of directly in that chapter on Lydia Davis. So that's kind of like my second favorite.
All right. I wonder if we can spend the last few minutes of the conversation here talking about literary criticism.
Okay.
And about kind of how you imagine yourself as a literary scholar, and how maybe how you imagine the field. You cite in the book Paul Ely's remark that fiction has lost its faith, and I'm wondering whether, and now clearly you show that that's not necessarily true in the way you address all of these writers that you talk about, and you've already elaborated in this conversation on why that'd be the case. What about literary criticism? Do the same rules apply to criticism that apply to fiction, or is that different?
Well, criticism lost its faith a long time ago, and one could argue is regaining it by this kind of, you mentioned the term post-secular kind of opening that's in literary criticism right now. The capital T theory movement of the 80s and 90s kind of reached its apex, and people realized you can't live inside of a critique, and that this is not helping us to understand fiction any better. And, you know, and we're having books like Rita Felsky's The Limits of Critique come out, and it's just like she's like thinking she's making some kind of new argument about how, boy, we should read fiction for other things. Duh, I've been saying this for, you know, my whole career. It feels so, because there's so much antagonism toward Christians in the academy still, in English, in literary studies in particular, that it's almost like the post-secular is this kind of way around, kind of the back door to the issues that we know are central to fiction itself, right? But it's tough to be a Christian scholar in literary studies because of that antagonism is still very real.
Yeah, it is.
Ely is writing partly because of that. Like he's writing to say, because he's writing from a Catholic perspective, more or less, that it's kind of a shame that we aren't even allowed to sort of ask these questions, you know, anymore. But he's making the case that fiction has lost its faith, meaning that there's no O'Connors or Percys or, you know, anybody like that writing today. And I, in that sense, would almost have to agree with him. You know, the way that Toni Morrison is a Catholic, which some say she is different from the, vastly different from the way that Percy or O'Connor would have been. But there's a strong case to be made, and I try to make it in my chapter on Beloved, that she has an incarnational way, an incarnational imagination, what I call an incarnational imagination, way of seeing the world, seeing the spiritual world.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So when you see the way you just described this, so as you put it, the post-secular provides, at least for some scholars, a way to kind of get back around to questions of religion, kind of the evocative, your religious experience in a way that, you know, kind of a John McClure would evoke it.
Yes.
Through kind of the back door. Is that, when you see that kind of criticism, do you say to yourself, good, there's a place for that. I'm glad it's there. It opens up new questions. Or do you say to yourself, you know, it needs to go one more step and make clear kind of the theoretical and in many cases the theological basis of its own attention?
That's an excellent question, and depends on what day you ask me. But most days I'm grateful for it because there is an opening, and at least we're being invited to the table, or not invited, at least not shunned from the table as Christian scholars in the same way. But yeah, I mean, there are some books that are particularly frustrating about what they will do and what they won't do. Like Tracy Fessenden has written a book that my late colleague Roger Lundeen did a great review of, that shows the kind of like still resistance to the idea that this might actually be true, rather than just it's like a sociological phenomenon, right? That there's just this ultimate kind of resistance to even the thought that we could be talking about something real. Now, that's not happening in everywhere, but in philosophy and in theology, of course, so much more engagement with these issues. I mean, I'm in a conversation about poetics and metaphysics going on right now at Cambridge because of COVID, and it's all on Zoom, so I get to participate. And I just got to participate in the conversation today on poetics and metaphysics. And those people are taking it seriously, right? But within literary studies proper, very few people are taking the idea that this might be real, that, you know, that God might be real, that he might actually express himself in the world, taking that idea seriously.
After, I want you to tell me about that conversation with poetics and metaphysics. That has me curious. But let me ask you right now. That's really interesting. I think that's right. I think there's such a resistance to really venturing a statement that would sound like a statement or an article of faith. That suspension is, I mean, there are good things about suspending belief, right? It keeps categories in play, but it's also safe, right?
So it's totally safe. Yeah. And unfortunately, I have to advise all of my students who go on to grad school to fly under the radar. You have to play safe if you want to get a job and even just be accepted into grad school. And that's so sick. I mean, there's something really almost evil about that. It's like you can't even ask certain questions in literary studies, right?
And the irony is that there's something dogmatic about it, which is the great irony.
Super dogmatic.
Yeah.
Super dogmatic. And it is ironic, absolutely, to the extreme.
So did you find your niche as a scholar who takes these questions of faith seriously? Did you know this was like a vocation for you in graduate school or before? Or did you kind of find this as you got to Wheaton and got going in your career and began writing, as a scholar?
No, I definitely was always thinking about it when I was in grad school. That's why I chose Flannery O'Connor for my dissertation. That became my first book. And I was working with Elizabeth Fox Genovese, who is a famous feminist historian, who, believe it or not, was converting to Catholicism while I was her student. I didn't have anything directly to do with it. I like to think I was encouraging to her. But I studied O'Connor through her classes first. And it was that point that I was like, I've arrived. I found the perfect intersection of women's writing, faith, and, art, the questions about art, and all these things, combined together for me. And so, I've always been there. And writing about Flannery O'Connor, I knew wouldn't necessarily deprive me of getting a job at a secular institution. Although when I first tried to publish the book at the University of Georgia Press, the letter I got back was, I'm too theological in my response to Flannery O'Connor. I wish I kept that letter because it was just the height of absurdity. Like my theological opinions are, sort of my bias or whatever is showing. But if I had written from a, whatever other perspective, it would have been fine. Right. But because I was writing from a theologically Christian perspective, it was somehow not okay. And to my mind, that's just exactly what we're talking about here. So for me, it's always been there, and now I can just have the freedom, as I said, to apply theological thinking to non-theological writers.
Right. Sure.
Yeah.
You've thought about this a lot. Let me ask you this as kind of the last question, I guess. It's kind of about the role then that you see Christian scholars playing in the academy. And including for those who don't share, your faith convictions. In The Flourishing Teacher, you have a line. You say that students need us to model lives lived in gratitude, faithfulness, and love much more than they need to learn math, biology, or history. And I guess I'm wondering if the same kind of thing applies for the Christian scholar. And what is it that others can see from a good Christian scholar that would be valuable, not just through the work that they do, but the way they go about that work?
Yeah, I have a colleague here. His name is Jay Wood, and he's done a lot of work on kind of the virtues of the intellectual life and what it means for a Christian to live the intellectual life with virtue. Right. Which means very simple things like not cheating, no plagiarism, that kind of thing. But it also means something else. It means having a whole life as a scholar, not just being, I am, single-mindedly focused on my work and whatever happens to my family or my students, who cares? But, thinking about it in a generous way, like I want to invite somebody else into a thought that might actually be revolutionary for them. And to me, the whole point of my work as a scholar is to get people to read fiction, because I think it's all in there. I think thinking through fiction is one of the great things that we can do. And it the imagination, as Denise Levertov says, is that perceptive organ that makes it possible, but not inevitable, to see God. Well, the imagination is at work all the time, not only in the writers, but in the reading of the things that we do. And so that what I want to do is get people to read fiction because it opens the door to faith and to just understanding conversions of all sorts, changing your mind. You know, what does it mean to change your mind?
Well, the book you've written here, Beyond the Story, subtitled American Literary Fiction and the Limits of Materialism, I think it goes a long way to achieving that kind of ambition and aspiration.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us. This has been really, I could talk to you for a much longer time. Christina, this has been great. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Sam Jacob. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you're interested in other episodes of this podcast or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.